We move to discussion and information, update and next steps on the proposed vacation rental dwelling business licensing program. And Mr. Belmont and I will start this off. I think we may have one or two people here to offer public input. We'll have further discussion by the Board of Commissioners. And we first brought this before the board a month ago after roughly 2 years of work on this, some community meetings, an increasing level of feedback about concerns and complaints about the impacts of vacation rentals on neighborhoods in the county outside of the incorporated cities. As we discussed in various formats, Newport, Lincoln City, and Yahats have all had vacation rental licensing programs in place for years, but the county's never gone there. So, as a next step, we had three public listening sessions, which Mr. Belmont and I co-hosted. There's a summary of the main suggestions in your packet, and I think we had about 25 people total at the meetings. We had certainly a lot of neighbors who have been impacted by VRDs, but we also had some property owners and managers. And well, certainly there is disagreement about certain aspects of the proposed measure, and one of them in particular, the proposed occupancy limit. And there were some questions and I'd say differences of opinion on how to approach certain other aspects. We didn't hear one person say that this was inappropriate, unnecessary, that we shouldn't do it. The vast consensus seemed to be it was a timely and appropriate measure. And I'm going to just throw out a few things that aren't listed in the comments, but interesting. I've heard a few people say, well, no, it's only a Glenedon Beach, Lincoln Beach issue. But as we heard from one of our constituents here today, who lives in Surfland in South Beach outside of the city limits, a decade ago they had one vacation rental. Now they have eight. We know they're present in Bayshore. They're present in other parts of the county. So if we are going to move on this, it seems like given the way the industry continues to grow, this really, I think, is a timely line to time to address it. And even though we've talked about the main reason for doing this is protecting quality of life in neighborhoods, we've also acknowledged that a secondary aspect is the need to hopefully level the playing field a bit and make sure that everyone is collecting the transient room tax. We've got a substantial number of these properties that are already doing that, but we know that there are ones out there who are not. And beyond, you know, the leveling of the playing field at the Waldport Forum, we heard from a couple of owners, you know, family-owned and operated motels in the South County area, and they pointed out something that I really hadn't thought of. You know, the motel industry is pretty heavily regulated. We're often the ones who carry out the regulations, but those are primarily set up in state law. And those folks were saying, yeah, this seems fair and reasonable to us. So I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Belmont now. Then maybe we can open it up to the public and then board discussion on a timeline and potential next steps.
Yes. Let me talk about some of the particulars that came out of the public forums in terms of potential tweaks to the ordinance that was proposed. And I'm looking for the first thing is the kind of base direction, and that is, can we proceed with this ordinance? Do you want us to proceed with the ordinance and get you something together that we can adopt? I'm going to just assume for sake of argument at this point that that is a direction you want to go, but I'll need that direction first and foremost. But if we do that, the kinds of issues I've identified, about seven or eight issues that I need some direction in terms of finalizing up the language of the ordinance, what your desire is to do with something. So one of the issues that we asked that all the forums had heard about was this idea that very well received. Actually, I don't know that anybody opposed at all having the idea that we have contacts for the VRD owners, so that if someone has a concern or a complaint, that there is a contact that can be made to resolve that complaint on an informal level at the first instance. But one of the things that we asked is the ordinance that right now doesn't designate that contact has to be local. And one of the things we asked at each of the forums was whether or not there was a desire or a feeling that should be a local contact, so that somebody could respond in a reasonable period of time to these kinds of complaints. And at least, and Bill, please correct me if I'm wrong, but what I heard overwhelmingly was the desire to make that a local contact. So if you're an owner of a vacation dwelling out of Salem, and you have it over here, you need to have somebody in place here locally who can respond to complaints about your VRD. So I need to have some direction on that particular issue. A second area that had a bit of discussion was on dealing with the garbage issues out there. And we had crafted the original ordinance was saying that you had to have garbage service. And luckily we do know that garbage service is available to every one of these residences in Lincoln County because of our franchise system. There is service that is available to everybody. But whether or not we should say that people had to take the service, it's mandatory to take the service, or could come up with an alternative. And we heard a little bit of a mix of things on there. There was at least an example of one owner who said that they had a housekeeping service. They came in and took the garbage away when they did the house cleaning. But that was a complaint we also heard a lot about, which is why we had that provision in there. The question I've got for you is, we could write this in such a way that says if you're going to get the VRD license, you have to have mandatory garbage service provided by one of the haulers out there. So I'd like some direction on that particular issue. We'll need to do some work on definitions and explanation. There were some questions raised about the definitions of sleeping areas, bedrooms, a couple of other things. I'm going to tweak on some of those. I think they were great suggestions. And I'm going to spend some more time trying to refine those particular definitions. A fourth area was response times. This engendered quite a bit of discussion, too. And that ranged from people saying that 20 minutes was too long to those that said that was way too short in order to have some kind of response, that we needed more like an hour or maybe even more to do that. And did that need to be, the response need to be in phone or in person? How does that actually work? And so I think we need to do some clarification of that particular issue. I need to at least define what that is a little bit better, what we mean by the word response when a complaint is received. And I'm going to look at a couple of other ordinances that are out there in terms of that particular issue and come back with some recommendations. But that was one I think that does need some clarification. A very interesting suggestion was made on the notice requirement. We require in here that the licensee notify other residents within 250 feet of the area of all this information. Who's the contact person? This is going to be a VRD. How do you go through making that contact? Our ordinance, the way it works right now, puts the onus back on the VRD owner to make that notification. We can assist because we have the ability through our geographic information system, GIS, to kind of run a line around a property and show the property owners, at least the assessment records, who those the adjoining property owners are. We can do that. But there are a couple of jurisdictions I've since discovered, I didn't know this, that actually have the licensing agency do that. So when you come
in, Lincoln City does that.
What they do is they charge an additional fee for that particular service, but that ensures that the notification is made. It really puts an incumbent back on the licensing agency to send out that notification. So I do want to explore that one. I thought that was an interesting way to make sure that the notice that needs to go out gets out to everybody, and then we can actually ensure that it gets out there. So some direction on that, but I really would like to explore that particular provision and see if we can make some changes. Of course, as Bill indicated, one of the big issues is occupancy limitations. We have received a couple of letters from owners of larger scale existing operations who have made some arguments that it violates their rights if we put in an occupancy limitation. And there's a variety of legal arguments. I'm not going to go into any detail. about those. A lot of those relate to this question of whether or not this is a land use ordinance and whether or not we're making a change in land use. And as I've made very clear, and I'll make clear again, this is not a land use ordinance. And that's, you know, there's a different analysis that goes into this when you're looking at our licensing regulatory side than several other jurisdictions, including Lincoln City and some other cities, who have made changes in their land use code. Then that triggers, you know, some additional analysis. But that's new information that's been provided. I am going to review all the claims that have been made. We're going to do some more legal research on this particular issue. I am not saying at this point that you, as a matter of course, that you need to abandon occupancy limitations. I think you can include those. An additional thing that was registered in with the idea of nonconforming is that you grandfather, that's the term that's used a lot of times, grandfather in existing uses so they can have operated at over that occupancy limit. If that's something you desire to do, you need to give me some direction to look into that. And that's a policy issue that I think was raised, as well as potentially a legal issue that was raised. But at this point, I'm not recommending, other than I do need to look at the language we've got in there. I need to tweak the language that we've got that sets limits, but I need some direction. Is that something you want me to continue to pursue, is those occupancy limitations, or modify it in any way, shape, or form? If we do... there's another aspect that we heard of during the last month of having additional enforcement capabilities and options, and something that I had not thought about specifically and have not seen. I'm not aware of anybody that does this, but there may be some ability to contract out some additional enforcement. I'd like to work with the sheriff's office on that particular thing. One of the things that would be really nice in pulling this thing together is make it real clear that we've got the capability of actually, you know, once these regulations are in place, have the mechanisms to actually make sure that they're enforced. And so I would like to explore those additional enforcement options before we finalize up this particular ordinance. If we were to do those, if we were to do things like the notice, other things that puts more responsibilities back on us, I do want to make sure that it's clear that I will make a different recommendation on the fee schedule, and we would actually make sure those costs are passed through, and we'll do some estimates on what those might be and figure that out. So that would be another area in which we might make a change. I do need to, not as part of this ordinance, but just in terms of some, the issue came up and we need to clarify, is for purposes of our transient room tax code provisions. I need to clarify, it's already in there, but we just need to clarify for all the parties what incidental use is and what that means. And I need to work with the treasurer's office so that's clear. And as we go out, one of the requirements of this ordinance or this licensing scheme is that you have to pay your transient room taxes and be current on those in order to get and maintain a license. And so we need to do a little clarification on that, make sure that's out there for everybody to understand. And then finally, the one thing that we talked about was the effective day and a grace period. It's not one of those things that you can put out day one and say you have to have a license day two. And we recognize that. We're putting together a number of forms, information applications, the licenses themselves that need to get out there. And we need to give people a period of time in which to get those licenses before we actually actively go out and say, you know, you're in violation because you don't have a license if you're operating a VRD. And the way we can do that, actually, as I went back and looked at the way the ordinance provisions work, we're not going to adopt this ordinance by an emergency clause. We're going to adopt it by the normal manner you adopt one, which requires that it becomes effective 90 days after the date you adopt the ordinance. So what I'm proposing to do is write some language in here that makes it clearer that during that 90 days, we will have the licensing applications and forms available. People can come in and make those applications. And that would be the grace period we build in, is that grace period. So the day one of the effective day, you'll be expected to have a license, but there will be built in a process to get that license 90 days before that. And that will cover the grace period. In terms of scheduling, if you so desire with these changes, I would recommend that you actually do a first reading of a final ordinance on June 1st at your June 1st meeting, and a second reading on June 15th, and that'll get you that July 1 adoption, before July 1 have an adoption date for the ordinance.
So it would be then effective, or no, it would be adopted as of July 1, and then the months of July, August.
No later than July 1, because we may adopt it, you know, as soon as the 15th. You may adopt it on the 23rd meeting. You know, we may adopt it sometime in June. You'll adopt the ordinance, and then it's just 90 days from then that it becomes effective.
And in that 90-day period, we'd be encouraging people to get their licenses.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So that's the report I have based on what we heard. I really do appreciate the public input. It's been very, very helpful to hear both the concerns from folks on all sides of this, mm-hmm. this thing. It's something new, as you're well aware, that the city of Lincoln City, the city of Newport, jurisdictions all up and down the coast and actually across the state are all looking at these particular issues and kind of looking at them anew and trying to find a kind of middle ground that is respectful of the VRD right, owner's rights, as well as the neighborhoods. It's not an easy task to do, but I think we've got a very good start on it.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Belmont right now, or do we want to see if anybody wants to be heard on this?
Interested in public comment.
Are you Mr. Mora?
I represent him.
Oh, okay. And we do have your testimony. Did you want to read that in the record, or just summarize it,
or we can just
enter this into the record?
Your choice.
If you would like to be heard, you need to. Microphone, please, so we can, because the meetings are recorded.
Okay.
So if you could introduce yourself, please.
My name is Peter Lear, L-E-A-O-R, and I'm a manager of Ocean Odyssey Vacation Rentals and Yachts. And I don't want to veer off of the reason I came mm-hmm. here, because I just actually found out about the meetings like the night before the last meeting. So we've been operating for 25 years down in Yachts. I went through the whole process with Yachts when they reviewed their procedures, and basically that all came about because of the growing nature of vacation rentals in residential areas, and maybe some operators were not following the real simple rules and guidelines. So I can say we've never had any problem with those, and I agree it's a good time to get the unincorporated areas online. So I understand all of that. So my reason to be here, though, is mm-hmm. to just get this letter from one of my owners. I manage 75 properties, basically in Walport and Yachts. And this one particular property has been operating as a vacation rental for more than 10 years. It used to be a nightclub and restaurant, I guess in the 40s and 50s, and it's just under 5,000 square feet. My issue is, we believe it has a non-conforming use, and we have families that have been coming there every year. So we already have bookings through 2017 and into 2018 already, and I would just respectfully propose that maybe some of these, there are a few, if you go and research, you'll find, I think I found like 20 to 25 such properties in Lincoln County that advertise that they sleep more than 16. And what Yachts did was grandfathered mm-hmm. in, and for new licenses, the new occupancy limits went into play. And just one last thing. I've been doing this for 6.5 years. I worked this vacation rental business through the big recession. We're invested. I actually find my primary residence surrounded by vacation rentals at this time in South Yachts, and I haven't had any problems. It's just they're simple rules and regulations. If the operators are following them, then all is well.
Okay.
That's kind of my...
Okay, can I ask you a couple of questions?
Yes.
Okay, so this property is just under 5,000 square feet, and it mentions 5.5 bathrooms, but how many bedrooms?
There are 7 bedrooms.
Okay. And what do you advertise it as a maximum occupancy?
30. There's 2 dormitory-styled sections of the entire downstairs of the home. That it's a big family reunion mm-hmm. rental.
Okay. Commissioners? Yes, Commissioner Thompson?
I struggle with buildings this size. Motel owners go through a whole different situation, and you're the number of residents that, to me, is a motel or a small hotel.
If you if you went to the site, you would see it looks and feels like a home. It's not like hallways with rooms.
So it's more like a boarding house.
The downstairs is an open area with a full kitchen and two bathrooms, and then the upstairs is...
In the 50s, 40s, there was boarding houses that were this similar type situation. And I struggle with how big do you go before you're into a different class of property.
I'm not a lawyer. I'm just...
It's my own struggle. I'm not trying to trap you or anything. Yeah. I struggle with this because, to me, a home is a single-family dwelling, and this is far bigger than a single-family dwelling.
Well, all I can say is over 10 to 12 years, we have never had a complaint from a neighbor, and we have a neighbor just to the south of the property, and we've always worked with them, and we've never had any issues at all.
I appreciate it. A lot of them haven't had problems.
Right.
And another,
right.
There's a few. It sounds like you're more engaged locally with your property.
We
live there. A lot of times the absentee owner that seems to be struggling.
I work this business 7 days a week. I'm available 24 hours a day. This is not a hobby for me. I take it very seriously. And Yahats, we've never had any issues with any governing body.
Okay. Appreciate your input.
Yeah, thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Hunt?
If the residence or property has capacity for 30 people, how many cars could that be? I mean, you could have 15 cars.
The parking lot can accommodate 15 vehicles. It's a unique, it's a very unique...
Again, it doesn't sound like a home to me if it can park 15 cars, so...
It's just...
Excuse me.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, it's just the way the parking was laid out, and like I say, at one time it was a restaurant.
Yeah,
and,
this is a different property.
It's a very unique situation, and not right on Highway 101. It's just, there's nobody to the north of it. It's the state park. And it's just a very unique property.
Well, I share Commissioner Thompson's struggle, if you will. There are a few properties that are the square peg you're trying to fit in the round hole, and this sounds like one of them. But I think for the most part, as you've already stated, most of the properties within the county are managed in a respectful manner that allow livability and yet to give the owners the opportunity to gain some return. The question I have, as you look long range into the future, potentially, in fact, I'm sure sometime in the future, ownership of that property is going to change. Ownership of all of the properties will change probably sometime in the future. And so then what happens if you've got an ordinance that only addresses part of the problem or only addresses the properties that are a problem at the time you enact the ordinance? So I try to look long range and say, this is a good time to enact. It's actually not an ordinance. I guess it's regulations on a business. And try to address the problems now, but also put a plan in place that says that we're going to mitigate future possibilities of some of these issues. So, I understand your situation and respect the fact that you've been a responsible manager and owner of the properties.
But I guess my question is, I'm not a lawyer, but if a particular piece of real estate has been identified as a non-conforming use, does that change?
Well, yeah, generally, I mean, isn't non-conforming use apply to land use?
It does. And remember, we're not saying you can't use it as residential property. Right. We're not changing that at all. That's the underlying use, and we're not changing that at all. The jurisdictions that have done these things have actually gone in and banned this particular use, or tried to, or amortized it. You know, trying to do a variety, but limited to certain zones, and doing that. That's when you're in the land use arena, you've got some non-conforming use issues. This is a licensing program. It's not a land use program. So
we'll see.
We're still exploring the issue. We're going to continue exploring.
Just one last thing, if I could.
Of course.
You're talking about enacting the new regulations effective July 1st with a 90-day period.
Mm-hmm.
I would respectfully ask that you're asking for this 90-day period. It happens to be the 90 days of almost 100% occupancy of all of these vacation rentals. That could be a bit challenging for us to...
Right, so that is one of the ideas. I don't know how...
You could put the effective date later.
Or
make it December 1.
Say the occupancy, exactly, a limited time.
And in fact, I do want to note one thing, because you actually, thanks for raising this. It was another note, and I forgot to mention this, is that the initial or the additional license will actually be for more than a year, because we want to kind of take that little time frame, whatever it is, 60, 30, 90, whatever days during this year, and then have it effective for a year plus to do that. So you don't have to come back immediately and get another license.
Okay, Commissioner Thompson.
I ask this question to Wayne. So, the grandfathering in issue is a problem. By setting dates farther out, do we open the door for other places to get grandfathered in, or is that door already locked?
Well, it depends on how you define grandfathering. This is an interesting legal question. I could argue that I'm grandfathered in because I have a house that was built before the date of this ordinance as a residence.
That's right.
Therefore,
so they all could be.
So it could be only applying only to the houses built after that date if you're going to make that grandfathering argument. I don't buy that. I'm sorry. I just don't buy that. So there's a lot of legal nuances here. I'm not too worried about that particular issue. We might have to do it. And to be in all fairness, not your client, but other people have, you know, indicated they may challenge this part of the ordinance. And that's something that's happened. It was actually a part of a challenge. I mean, there was the whole question of whether this is a land use ordinance was challenged in Lincoln City. And Luba said the way the Lincoln City did it, and we're even extremely much more careful than Lincoln City has been, it's not a land use ordinance. Mm-hmm. So those kinds of provisions you can't, you know, are not applicable. So, I mean, it's obviously we're going to have to do some work on that. And this is an open area. This is an area that could be challenged, and we'll meet the challenge if necessary.
I just want to kind of respond to what you just said, Terry. And, when we talk about grandfathering in, wouldn't it be as easy as just identifying these unique properties that you can easily prove have been running them correctly and paying the Lincoln County tax for years and years and years, and maybe those are the properties that you identify as being able to be grandfathered in. Like I say, I'm not a lawyer. I'm just trying to...
Yeah, no, I like the way you're thinking.
Although I will say this, that remember, this started because of some of these larger ones who were not complying with these requirements.
Let me make this up. I'm not a lawyer either. I try to do things fair for people.
Right. When this whole issue was going on in Yahats, I basically would sit in the back of the room and listen. And, you know, I'm not really a public speaker, but occasionally I would feel a need to come up here and just try to talk as a common sense thinker. And people have been doing this and not doing it properly. And for someone like me that has always done it the right way, it can get a little
Right.
Understand. So, you know, unfortunately, it's kind of the 80-20 rule of life.
I understand. That, yes.
You know,
exactly right.
So
that's the challenge.
Just thinking out loud, could I ask a question to Mr. Belmont? And I don't know, again, where we want to go on this or not, but that if we did want to do, you know, hypothetically, a grandfathering of these larger properties, would it have to be a blanket, or could we look at them on a case-by-case basis? I mean, I'm thinking about this property, for instance, with that has a parking lot for 15 versus in Glean Beach, Neptune Avenue, narrow dead-end street with two places.
Can I suggest there are alternatives? There are alternatives, and I don't know, and it seems to me, I remember the Sandcastle because I know the property pretty well over the last number of years from the things. That this may be one that's a classic case and where it's sitting there that maybe the resolution of your issue is a zone change. Get it out of residential. And you don't have this issue. Non-issue.
Yeah.
And I'm not, I'm not saying that we're committing to that at all, but I would actually, if I was on the other side encouraging this owner, the first thing I'd be doing is going to the planning department and saying, look at all the things you describe. You know, in terms of the what's there and where it's going, is that this is unique, and it could be that it could be resolved fairly simply by his own change.
Hmm.
So I don't know. I don't know if that's actually a solution, but there may be other ways to look at this.
So I'm looking at it kind of along your line, because some of these, it's the ones that haven't paid taxes, but there are residents that have paid the taxes, and up front. Can that be used as a tool to say, look, if you haven't paid taxes previous to this...
But that's not the issue. I'm not saying that that's going to be that would not be the breaking point of whether you paid taxes or not. That's one issue you look at. You got it.
Well, it'd be a breaking point for grandfathering.
But I guarantee you, the issues that started this thing in the first place, they're paying the tax.
Yeah, like the Neptune Avenue house.
Yeah, they're not. That's not, you know, if you grandfather them, the one that really started this whole issue with the occupancy stuff would be grandfathered in under all the same things. And so it's the policy choices you have to make with these things that are difficult. And I think your 80-20 analogy is very good. You know, even if 80% of them are doing the right things and not causing problems in the neighborhood, the other 20% are the ones that drive the regulatory scheme. It's unfortunate. But that's the kind of policy choices you got to make.
Right.
I will say this. The one thing that I was a little bit not sure how to deal with is the question of, do you have a grace period for somebody? I mean, you do raise the issue if you booked out for a period of time. You know, do you have a grace period that says, all right, we're going to allow you, the occupancy limit goes into place, but you can have that occupancy limit through December 31st. Or something like
that's
that.
That's another potential way to address
if
it.
If you wanted to address so that at least the current bookings, that's taken care of.
Commissioner Thompson.
It's not a case of current bookings. It's people have had investments. They've invested their money into Lincoln County. They've been legal up to this point. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden, you make it illegal. And I have a problem with that, of being in the fishing industry and watch boats just destroyed, and a whole fleet destroyed here in Newport, because the federal government made decisions. And so I'm going to have struggle with this one, I'll tell you right now, because these people didn't do anything wrong. They found properties that had proper sewer for everything and built it. The problem is how do you cap it in a way that's fair and they can move forward? And so we're going to struggle with this, I can tell you right now. This is not going to be an easy decision.
This meeting, is there going to be audio of it?
Audio and video.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
I just can't remember. A lot of things have been said that I want to make sure my owner gets to hear.
Yeah, typically it's posted either later.
I'm sorry? Yeah.
His letter is in the record. We'll have that.
Yeah. So. Typically the audio and video of the meeting is often available the same afternoon and usually no later than the next day.
All right.
Yeah.
Anything else, sir?
No, I thank you for letting me speak, and I just, this is my last career, and it's a big deal. So I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else who wants to be heard today? Come on up, please. Introduce yourself. Sign in.
Denise Ross. I don't have a whole lot to say. I live in Surfland in South Beach, and I'm president of the Homeowners Association. And as Commissioner Hall said, this is an issue that has expanded greatly in the last 10 years of Surfland's life. And I have all the respect in the world for the trying to balance the needs of the residents with the needs of the business owners. Completely agree with Commissioner Thompson about how if you come in and you've made a legal investment in a business, that to have that taken away, you know, seems unfair. I would like to balance that with the idea, I'm sure it's occurred to you, that residents have also made an investment in property. We bought property often. When we bought it, Surfland was a little bit run down. People have bought it, have fixed up homes, have put in a lot of equity in the idea of a small residential area with pedestrian-friendly streets, and that's also our investment. So balancing the fairness is an issue, and you're working, as far as I can tell, you're trying very hard. Interestingly enough, on Sunday, we had a chance to do like a pretest of the ordinances you're talking about here. Is that we woke up on Sunday morning, and a vacation rental in our neighborhood, which has a maximum occupancy by the decision of the owners for 8 people and 3 cars, had 7 cars in their driveway and 5 cars lined along the street in a narrow street that would have blocked emergency vehicles. This happens to be a wonderful property owner who has previously supplied the association with information and contact. And so I hear about it. I call them in Washington. He's appalled. He said he'll call either his manager or the sheriff and take care of it. So he's in Kennewick, Washington, but within 20 minutes, the cars are peeling out of there. And then within an hour, there's one car in the driveway. As far as I'm concerned, that was a very reasonable response time, very reasonable outcome, and it solved the problem. So, it's not think of the children, but think of the residents also as you go forward with this. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Ms. Ross? Okay, no. Thanks.
Point one.
All right. What if we start talking through some of the aspects of this, and let's maybe tackle some of the lesser ones first, and then the bigger one. Local contact. I don't know how everyone else feels, but I think changing to a local contact should be mandatory. It could be an owner-manager, it could be a management company, or I think as was raised at one of the meetings, we talked about our hypothetical property owner in Philomath who's booking and managing her own property, but if she wants to contract with a local security company to handle the 24-hour response, that would be acceptable, just so there's something local to respond at all times. Thoughts on that?
Well, I thought the public testimony that I heard was overwhelmingly in favor of providing local context.
And that was the same thing we heard at the 3 public listening sessions.
Now, I don't know the percentage overwhelming, but with the percentage of people that were just dwellers in the area, or with the percentage of people that own VRDs? I mean, look at the percentage.
I don't think we heard one person say it shouldn't.
I believe it was residents that lived in the area.
Yeah, right. I can see why they would want that.
But also the management people. Nobody, I don't know if they all specifically weighed in affirmatively for it, but they were all aware that this was the direction we were likely headed based on the testimony so far, and not one of them objected to it.
And I might say this anecdotally, but I think all the VRD owners that showed up, they all had local contact.
Right. Right. So, are you comfortable with including that, Commissioner Thompson?
Well, it's to our advantage to do it. I'm not sure that it's absolutely necessary. It depends, like she stated, the attitude of the people.
Right.
How you...
But again, that's an out-of-state owner, but they've got a they had a local herd manager.
Yeah.
So could
well,
be...
Well, again, I think we need to look at this regulation as... You know, addressing all of the possibilities, and certainly there are a lot of people that are in compliance, but we've got some that aren't, and it's a problem. So, to me, it's a relatively minor aspect of the.
So, how do you limit it so it's not necessarily managers? Say you have contract with the security. Classified as a manager.
Yeah, we'll describe it. It's not manager.
No, it's
contact.
A local contact. It does not specify local manager.
You have to go to a property manager.
No,
local contact.
I don't want to force everybody into a property manager.
No, not at all. Yeah, like we said, the hypothetical person in Philomath who handles their own bookings, does their own property maintenance, but obviously could not respond within a... If an in-person response was needed, could not do that on a timely basis, they could contract. You know, I think the scenario that came up at least a couple of times was one of our local security firms. They could be the point of contact to do the immediate response.
There are all a wide variety of different individuals, organizations that could be a local contact.
Yeah, so... We will mandate a local contact then. Okay, response times. We were really all over the map on that in public input. I mean, anywhere from 15 minutes to 1 hour, and I think maybe, you know. But that was generally the window that we were talking about. And just my personal take, I think, again, trying to be reasonable, I would lean toward the 1 hour standard because... You know, it's going to be one thing if it's 2 o'clock on a Saturday morning in March. It's going to be another thing if it's 7 o'clock at night. It's 7 o'clock on a Saturday evening in July, and maybe the manager has to travel from Newport to Rose Lodge or something. Dealing with summer traffic. But again, you know, I think Mr. Belmont, didn't you talk about writing it in something like that? This would be the maximum response time. In other words, if they get a call, you don't wait 59 minutes and then start driving, that we still will be looking for a reasonable effort and a timely response.
Do we have any idea what other...
You know, I'm going to look at a little bit. I'm going to look at that a little bit more.
I think we need to be reasonable. I mean, you know, 5 days.
It may be also that what we do.
5 days.
Yeah, and it also may be the things that you distinguish between phone and in person. Yeah. You know, and you can put some requirements in here that you have that phone contact with whoever is renting your facility, so you can make the call and deal with that. So I'd like 1 hour maximum would be great. It gives me some guidance, and then I'll look at some other things to try and tweak this.
It's like a pretty fast time to me, but I've never done this.
Well, starting point for further conversation.
Yeah.
So
let's
do some further research.
See what others are and see if we can come up with something that's a little bit standardized.
Okay. Garbage. That was something, you know, again, we heard pretty overwhelmingly to mandate local garbage service, and this was a problem, you know, not even so much with littering in the yard of a property, but people get up in the morning and open their own garbage cans, and suddenly they're filled with garbage that's not their garbage, and that's something that's just not happening occasionally. It seems to be happening a lot. You know, we did hear from the one owner who manages her own property in Lincoln City who said she has a contract housekeeping service, and they go in and do a cleanup after every rental, and as part of that housekeeping service they carry out the garbage. So I don't know, it just seems for simplicity and consistency, just mandating local garbage service would be the simplest and cleanest thing.
I do know this, that one of the, I just actually recently had a conversation with one of the franchised haulers on a different matter and kind of broached this subject. And the one thing that they said, and I think it's consistent with the other haulers too, is they have a variety of services there. They can actually, you know, they can do will call. So you call when you've actually got the service, and they can do a variety of different service levels, you know, that match the actual utilization of the property. So that you're not necessarily stuck doing weekly garbage if there's periods of the year that you don't have any service at all. So there are some ways to do that. It's just, you know, we can talk about having adequate garbage service for the level of use.
Okay. Yeah. Are we in agreement there, I think, for a direction?
Makes sense to me.
Yeah.
That one. Okay.
Giving notice and... Do you want to research a little more, Mr. Belmont, on whether we should put that onus on the property owner or look at doing it?
I'd like to really look more at the Lincoln City one. I sort of like that because that's, you know, one of the concerns we had with that. It really does, it is something that we might have the capability of doing it. Lincoln City apparently has been successful with that particular thing. I'd like to look at that more, talk with Sheriff's Office too about doing that in terms of how we would accomplish that. We've got the tools, I think, to do that. You know, it might be a little bit easier to do that. So I would like at least the option of exploring that and coming back and reporting back to you on that one.
Okay. Is everybody okay with that?
I'm fine with that.
And then related to notice, the distance. I assume you picked 250 feet because that's kind of a standard, even though this isn't a land use major, but that is in kind of in land use, that's our standard zone
standard
of notification.
Yeah. And I couple of other VRD ordinances.
So let me put this out there because it did come, it wasn't a dominant issue, but a few people did raise it. They said in some of the neighborhoods, like they said, there are no year-round residents within 250 feet of a VRD. And given that noise problems especially can travel beyond 250 feet, should we look at a greater zone of notice?
And the way I would respond to that is, remember, we do have a requirement that you post signage on the property.
So that
includes that contact information.
Yeah.
I can walk down the street, and it's got to be visible.
Yeah.
You know,
so you could walk down the street.
I can walk down the street, and there's the sign that says, managed by such and such, and here's the phone number contact information.
Okay.
So there is an alternative for those who are outside the 250 area.
Okay. All righty. How about the occupancy limit? I think this is going to be our biggest sticking point, and it's the one thing.
Can I suggest that I still want to do a little bit more of the legal research to make sure we're on firm ground with this and come back to you with that based on some of the things that have been raised here. Although I'm feeling very confident we can do this, it's really the policy issue to me is that do you want to establish it? Do you want to leave it at 16? Do you want to choose a different number? Do you want to have grandfathering? Those are probably the three key elements.
Right. So, like, one alternative would be to say any existing larger than 16 are grandfathered, but we won't license any new ones above the 16 cap.
I'm not sure 16 cap is right.
How come?
Well, 16 is still a lot of people. You're bucking up against this idea of what level is, you know, you're in a residence. It's 16 the right cap.
Yes. I'll tell you, the 16 is sort of based on some things that are within the building code that differentiate between lodging houses and straight residences, you know, those kinds of things. In fact, that's one of the things that they're raising, that, you know, an issue. And I'm just using that as a guideline. It is a logical breakpoint for things like fire codes, you know, that kind of stuff in terms of things you've got to do with your structure for some of these things. Although that's, you know, there's a lot of interpretations going there. We're wrestling with that. There's no magic to the 16 number, per se. It's just that you've got to set something in here if you're going to have an occupancy limit. And, you know, I hear you, Terry. Some people may say that's too high. It should be lower than that. But that seems like a good, reasonable, and especially tied into the additional thing of so many people per bedroom. That kind of thing. Tied in very nicely to a typical, you know, five-bedroom house, you know, fits in.
One thing, would you be comfortable, I mean, if we do go with a cap of 16 or another number, at least saying that that's effective perhaps January 1 of next year, so for the folks who are booked out for this summer, it's not impacting bookings this summer?
Well, you know, I see two different issues, grandfathering versus what I'll call a phase-in period.
Right, phase-in would be the
and, you know, I recognize there are people that have made investments in properties, and by putting a cap on the number of occupancies, we may be impacting their business. At the same time, I mean, we deal in making policy decisions where there's winners and losers every time we make one. So whenever I'm making a decision, I'm always trying to say, you know, what's in the best interest of the most people over the longest period of time? And as has been indicated already in testimony before us, yes, you have a few properties, some of which are few large properties, some of which are in compliance and some of which are not. But you've also got, all of those areas are surrounded by residents. And so, you know, how do you balance the needs of and rights of the business owners versus the residents? And, you know, in an ideal world, you could provide incentive to some properties that are doing a good job of being responsible and manage that. But I don't think we have the ability to pick and choose who is, you know, grandfathered. So I look at a phase-in period that would make a uniform policy for all properties, but I'm certainly open to further consideration as to what that magic number is for properties.
Mr. Belmont, another question for you. I'm sure you'll be looking at this as you complete your research, but I think a letter from the attorney for a couple of other large property owners raised this, and Mr. Morrow's raises this, essentially a suggestion that the occupancy cap could violate the Federal Fair Housing Act. And just, I'm acquainted with the former longtime director of the Fair Housing Council of Oregon, spoke with her about this informally, and she, you know, just her initial response without any research was that generally the fair housing laws are held to apply to long-term rentals, you know, longer than 30 days, not the short-term rentals that we're talking about
in
here.
The same way that the Landlord-Tenant Act in Oregon doesn't apply to a motel room.
Right.
You know, unless it's rented out longer than a period of time, doesn't it? You know, so no, there's requirements for that. I do not think this violates that.
Okay. I'm just trying to think. Mr. Belmont, any other issues that came up?
Well, two things I would like to know is that, do I also have permission to recommend some different fee structures if we go with the notice provision?
I think that's important.
It's important to me to know that that's something we can look at. Then the second thing is some direction to look at some of these additional enforcement kind of mechanisms that might, I think, be very useful.
Okay.
In terms of doing that, I work with the sheriff's office to take a look at that. And then use the 90 days effective date for the ordinance as the grace period. So if those things are all things I can explore, I'd appreciate some consensus to do that.
Well, I guess I'm not sure on your last comment there.
Well, that's the 90 days. Remember the date you adopt the ordinance. It'll be effective.
So a phase-in period?
It's a phase-in period.
But it's not longer?
Well, no, we can do longer if you'd like. Well, I guess I'm looking for that.
I think I'd be open to discussion about longer.
Okay.
Recognizing the fact that July, August, September, and October are very busy times for those properties.
Okay.
But I'd be open to that.
Well, then I'll also look at the effective date and do some research on that.
Okay. I'm fine with moving forward with a further look at these issues and bringing this back to us. You expect maybe in about a month?
First meeting in June for a final ordinance, okay. But we'll probably come back and talk about this some more as we do so before that time.
Commissioner Thompson?
I still haven't heard. We talked. You mentioned grandfathering, but you haven't told me where you guys are thinking, what you're thinking.
I thought I'd address that.
Well, you addressed
phase-in.
Two different things. But grandfathering in is...
I said I don't see a way to be able to grandfather properties fairly, recognizing some are in compliance and some are not, that also addresses the long-term situation where different properties are going to change ownership and you'll have different levels of responsibility. So to me, phasing in the ordinance is a way to address some of the short-term issues, but in the long range, I think the reason we have the problems or the degree of problems that we have is because of some of these larger properties.
Let me ask you the question then, because you still haven't answered what I'm talking about. I'm worried about this guy has the investment. Do you agree?
We're not saying he can't continue to operate the property.
Well, then there you've got a grandfathering in.
No, I would say you're phasing in the limit on the number of residents.
Can't operate it in the way you've always done.
And it's not unusual to have business license requirements change.
Sorry about that. I just kicked the phone. I turned and looked at you and kicked the phone.
I thought I heard words from heaven.
We would like direction.
Yeah.
Well, that was that.
Well, not zap.
Well, you're saying that they would be allowed in if they've been there.
No. I'm saying that whatever the occupancy limit that we establish would be applied to all properties.
Yeah. Like, say, if it's 16, we might adjust that, but right now in the proposed language is 16.
Because I don't see a way.
I'm going to struggle with that. Because here's a business that's legal, and all of a sudden you cut even half.
Well,
maybe.
Again, I think there's precedences where business license requirements have required the property or businesses change the way they do their business.
Absolutely.
And again, there will be some losers, but I don't see a fairer way to do it, recognizing the broad range of properties that are involved and the potential for property ownership to change over time, which means you got one problem here that goes away, and then you get a problem over here that comes back.
Well, I may see this one differently then.
That's
because the property owners made a decision when they put a sewer system in there, even though they may not have realized it, that it allowed these properties to be built. Once they're built...
Well, you're talking Glidden and Lincoln.
They aren't running this many people on a sewer tank. It's on a sewer system.
Yeah.
So, I mean, on a septic tank.
Right.
I don't know. I'm just going to have... We'll see what Wayne comes up with.
It's not an easy issue.
I'm hearing this is obviously an area that's struggling.
But again, you've got one property owner, and you may have 20, 30 residents, some of whom bought their homes long before that property was developed. So who was there first?
But in my case, in Glen Eden Beach, those people came to the county, should not have got a sewer system put in. Even though I'd like to see sewer systems up and down the coast, and they got the sewer system in because they wanted it, but it also opened the door to this larger buildings being built.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whose fault's that?
Fair question.
That's a fair question.
They just assumed it was going to say a quaint little village. Well, it didn't. And now they're turning around and saying, wait, we're going to go back and make this retroactive to these places that were built.
I agree with your question.
They didn't see foresighted. I'm not sure.
I struggle with this one. Okay,
because,
sure. I mean, really,
I understand that. Again,
I think probably, say, 30 years ago, the vacation rental industry really primarily was folks renting out their retirement home or weekend home when they weren't present to generate some extra income. And this phenomenon of building these places, of course, we heard about a case all its own today, but the just in the last, 15, 20 years, these brand new 4,000 square foot places built and advertised to sleep 20 or more, that's a pretty new phenomenon. And
it is.
It happened in Rhodes End, and we struggled with that, before it was annexed into Lincoln City, and now we're seeing it in Glen Eden Beach. The fact, this idea of people building homes specifically as full-time VRDs is a pretty new phenomenon, and again, something that nobody foresaw when they put in those sewers in Glen Eden in the 70s. So I'm struggling too, but I'll say right now at the moment, I want to hear Mr. Belmont's further research. I'm leaning in the direction that Commissioner Hunt is, that a cap just really seems reasonable to me.
Okay.
but a phasing in that occupancy to at least not impact the summer 2017 season. Anything else on that at this point?
You had summer of 2016.
16, yes. Yes. Getting ahead of myself.
Okay.
All righty.
I think that gives me some direction.
Do you have questions and answers?
Oh, yeah, sure. All right. Do you want to be heard on this? If you do, you need to come on up, please, because the meeting's recorded and we need to get it on record.
I don't like that, but I did have a couple questions.
Okay. You need to come on up, please, Cody.
My name is Cody Gray.
Uh-huh.
I live in Celeste. I have some rental houses, but I'm not doing what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about a cap of, I've been to four or five of these parties at these houses. You know, my church does them around mm-hmm. the area at different times. What I see with occupancy, I mean, you know, you need to have, I mean, a three-bedroom house you can maybe put six people in one room. You know, you have to look at the square footage of the buildings and the area, you know, the area that it takes. You can't just say, well, if you got a 4,000 square foot house, you could put 50, 60 people in there and accommodate them real easy. It's like I said, if the sewer system's properly. But if you got a 1,000 square foot house, I've seen 15 or 20 of us in a place like that a couple of different times, and it worked out okay. It's hard to... There must be a square footage thing or something that you come up with.
Well, it's tied to the number of bedrooms.
Right, apartments. Yeah.
But then also putting a maximum cap of 16.
Yeah. But what if you got a 4,000 or 5,000 square foot house here that you could probably put 30 or 40 people in? You put a cap on it and stopping him from doing
that. That seems to be our number one issue. And,
what,
you know, again,
I see that. Something like that. You know, you need to be able to set up some kind of occupancy, you know. And you guys are going to have to hire somebody to do it or do something.
Yeah, and that's part of the provision, too, that the sheriff's office would hire a part-time enforcement officer.
Right. Well, yeah, you're looking... That was my other question, you know.
And
maybe he has problems with people parking there. I mean, every one of them I went to, there's been problem parking.
Yeah.
I mean, realistically.
Yeah.
And when you give a one-hour time, I mean, I have rental houses... I can't get to my rental houses usually in 1 hour. I'm working someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're talking apartment rental people, maybe they can handle it. But 1 hour isn't very long to respond. And if they don't respond within an hour, you're going to give them a ticket, or you know you're going to have some kind of enforcement. Or I mean,
yeah, the ordinance gives kind of basically an escalating complaint procedure where the neighbors. We ask them to try and resolve it informally, then they can file a more formal complaint, and it's a very graduated but escalating process that the ultimate hammer, and hopefully we never have to get there, but the cities seem to deal with this on occasional basis, every now and then, even taking it to a hearing to revoke the license to rent. But that would be the last resort.
You know, I see a scenario coming here that I've seen before where you have a resident that's a little disgruntled or there's maybe a problem between owners, and they'll start filing complaints in order to remove that place.
Yeah,
and
just as we deal with a lot of existing land use measures. And I think, Wayne, do you want to address that? Because that did come up at one of the meetings from one owner who felt like...
Yeah, well, the complaint has to be a valid complaint. The one good thing about having this run through the sheriff's office as being a licensing agency is they can cut the wheat from the chaff.
Yeah.
They have a very good capability of determining, is this, is somebody looking at this is trying to use it as a sword to do a neighbor. And frankly, we do this in code enforcement all the time with existing regulations.
Yeah.
We have to actually deal with that, which is why we give discretion to the sheriff's office as a licensing agency to make some determinations. Are these legitimate complaints or not? And they can make that determination. People can appeal it, obviously, we've got a mechanism, but I think having a very experienced agency to deal with things that has to deal with complaints all the time like this is going to make it much more workable.
Well, I'd go further and say, I mean, the sheriff's office is dealing with the degree of severity of infractions of all types.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So it's certainly not an uncommon area where they would be making those types of decisions.
Right.
But anyway, just a couple things.
Sure, appreciate the input.
That I look, having rental properties myself, I see the problems all the time. My neighbors always complain about some other neighbor. You're going to have that no matter where you're at. And the problem that I see is just policemen. It's one of the problems. And good luck with that. And everybody's really busy.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Do we have any vacation rentals that we know of in Siletz right now? This is only for short-term rentals, 30 days or less.
I don't know if there is or not. I never stayed in one. You got one going out of Newport here that I've been at.
Oh, yeah.
Can I make one more comment?
Sure, come on up, please.
Listening to the balance you're trying to strike here between the number of occupants and response time in particular, thinking in my own neighborhood, very dense little neighborhood, is that, and I can certainly see the argument for not limiting the number of occupants in a building. And I can see the argument of the property manager who says they can't get there right away. If I were doing this, I would say that the issue is primarily noise and parking. Mm-hmm. There's nobody in my neighborhood who cares how many people are jammed into a house on a weekend. Love the idea of reunions and parties, right? But it's about the noise. Because if they're out on the deck partying at 2 o'clock in the morning and you have to get up at night, in the morning to work, that is an issue that's more than just an aesthetic quality of life. That's an issue. So if the ordinance could, and this is where I'm going to put my opinion in, if the ordinance could require, I have no idea of legality, Wayne, if the ordinance could require that the renters give a telephone contact number to the manager or to the owner.
Yeah, that's one of the things we're going to consider.
Well, and then in that case, the response time for noise for a parking could be almost immediate, like what happened Sunday in our neighborhood. And so it might remove the thorniness of how many people you're allowed to jam into a house as long as those bodies don't impact the quality of life of the residents. So I would request that do what you want with the occupancy. That's primarily a health and safety issue as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. But the response time is critical.
Okay. Yeah, an argument was offered. I think the attorney who came to our meeting in Newport, who represents a couple of the larger properties, basically it was his contention that we've got the tools in there already with the parking noise and garbage provisions to deal with the quality of life impacts on the neighborhood. But, that's one viewpoint.
Thank you.
So, yes. Yes, sir.
Well, I'm glad I stayed around. I'm just really concerned with you kind of putting out there that this particular property that I manage is basically safe for the next 4 months when I already have all of next summer booked by people that have been coming there for every year for 10 to 12 years. It's if I have to suddenly contact all of those families and tell them that they can't come there, it's going to impact negatively on my business that I have worked tirelessly to do everything right and follow all the rules and regulations. I need you to really look at it just a little deeper. It's just
Like I say, we're not making any decisions now. We're still talking it through,
right?
And we're hearing you.
I know, but I'm hearing. I'm kind of hearing that two of you are kind of leaning one way, and like I said, I'm not familiar to all this, but I'm just speaking as a normal, common sense person. Mm-hmm. There are unique situations, and I just need that to be heard.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kenyon, did you want to be heard on this?
Well, yeah,
you're
right. I actually do.
Come on up, please, then.
This may help or may not help, but we'll see. I'm Roy Kenyon. I'm the Public Works Director for Lincoln County. And I deal mostly with the complaints that come into me about traffic on a lot of these public roads, the parking issues. And I've been listening to
you as a whole struggle with the cap on occupancy. And I'm kind of thinking from the roadside of things. And I think that it would make my life easier if it wasn't so much a cap on occupancy, but a cap on vehicles. You know, you can still get 16, 20, 24 people to a residence by utilizing, you know, two vehicles or three vehicles, depending on the vehicles. And if you put a cap on vehicles, it would then reduce the traffic that I get a lot of complaints about. It would reduce the parking issues. And to a certain extent, it may actually reduce some of the occupancy because there is, you know, a limitation to that. I don't know if that helps the discussion, if it hurts the discussion, or it's just kind of me thinking within my own little box. But anyway, that's really all I had to say.
Thank you. Well, some more food for thought, Mr. Belmont, and as you do research, maybe bring this back for discussion, even when we're ready to have a conversation about other alternatives. Yes?
One last point.
Okay.
This gentleman brought a great point. Through the whole process of Yahats going through this, the number one and number two complaints were trash and parking. And Yahats came down very specifically about the trash and the parking, the number of vehicles that can be on a property, not parked on lawns, neighbors, unoccupied residences in their driveways, because this was running rampant. So they, that's a very good point. Parking, how many vehicles?
And we just have to be a little careful, because I know one of the complaints about one of the large things was they actually bring in buses. You're going into the residential neighborhood and they're parking buses there.
Right. And that's like,
that doesn't really solve.
Right.
I mean, they made as much of a parking issue and a traffic issue.
Yeah, we've got a narrow, dead-end street.
So I hear what you're saying, but I don't know that. And that we'll explore.
We'll see.
I'd like to see a little bit more what Yahats did.
So. Can I ask?
Yeah.
Roy, will you come back up? You're the person who knows the county roads better than anybody. And when parking, I have a problem when private property thinks they can take over public streets for parking. Public streets open to everybody. It doesn't make any difference whether it's a bus or a car or what it is.
That's correct. Yes.
The point is, be careful with this one, because you're stepping on the rights of the public property, and sometimes these residents think they own that street.
Yeah, well,
they don't. It's a public, it's a public street, and
that is true. And when I have people come in who complain about on-street parking, I basically tell them that the public has the right to utilize the street for parking, but they don't have the right to block it.
Right,
and that's where it becomes an issue. And so if there are three or four vehicles or a passenger bus parked on one of these narrow public roads that actually is blocking access, blocking emergency vehicles, then there's an issue. And so it kind of is a case-by-case, street-by-street problem. Some places there's plenty of right-of-way, there's plenty of width on the existing road, it's not an issue. Other places, there's adequate right-of-way, but the road hasn't been developed to the point where there's room for on-street parking. So, like I said, it's case-by-case, but yes, the public has the right to utilize the public right-of-way for parking.
Right, and that's something I think has come up at the meetings, and we have made clear to folks, you know, like where in one case, I think, for at least one street in Glendeaden, that they're working with the fire department trying to get it designated as a fire lane, no parking, and I think Mr. Belmont said, now you do realize if that happens, that applies to everybody, year-round residents and visitors alike. If it's going to be off-limits to parking, it's off-limits to parking for everybody. So, yes, sir.
Just one last thing. Yahats says, so I own property within the city limits of Yahats. I can park a 30-foot motorhome in my driveway. But if you have a vacation rental license, that property cannot have a motorhome parked on the property. Hmm. Hmm.
Yeah, that's
just throw it out there.
All right. Well, yeah. I think you've got some direction, Mr. Belmont.
I do.
And I think we need to move on now.
If I may, I think, as I've listened to some of the recent comments, it's, I guess, created an interesting thought process on my part. But you know, within reasons, if you, and hear me out, if you eliminated number of occupants, but you had clear noise ordinance, you had clear garbage ordinance, you had clear parking ordinances, and you were enforcing them effectively, maybe the number of occupants becomes somewhat academic. Again, within reason, as long as the people are there and they're not being noisy, they're not creating garbage, and they're not creating parking issues, is there a problem? Interesting thought process.
Because again, another.
I'm not so sure how you're going to get.
I understand.
But people in an area.
It's certainly, I think, yeah. Worth considering.
And then another question that came up, and I don't know if we really had a good resolution on that. A hypothetical: let's say Sheriff's Patrol does respond to a loud rowdy party at 1 o'clock in the morning at a vacation rental, and there's 18 people on premises, assuming we did have the 16 cap in place, are they going to do a bed check to determine our, you know, well, what if two people say, hey, we're staying at the motel down the road?
No, so, but what you can do is...
But yeah, obviously, if there's 30 people...
You can see the rental contract and see what their rental contract is.
So that is a tool. Okay. All righty, well, we've got some things...
Obviously, a dilemma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
come on up, please.
Sorry to keep bothering you. I'm a carpenter.
Yeah,
I work all the time.
Okay.
Uh-huh. After like 10 o'clock at night, you can't run a skill saw. I mean, right. You know, after 10 o'clock in the residential area, you can't be having noise parties.
Right.
I mean, realistically, you already got an ordinance, a city ordinance that takes care of that. I don't doubt that the county does, too. I mean, just look back at your ordinance and say, hey, party time shuts down, guys, at 10 o'clock.
Yep,
otherwise, the sheriff's going to drop by and knock on your door and say, quiet, man.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
And that costs money, and we don't want to have to be messing with you, you know. But, yeah, I mean, I've had that shitty guy come by a couple, three times in my life and say, you can't be doing that. I didn't mean to be bought. I try to get it done, you know.
I hear you.
But I think you're covered with that.
Thanks, Cody. All righty, we're going to move on to discussion item B, discussion of procedure to fill the Lincoln County Sheriff vacancy. Last week at a community forum, Sheriff Dotson announced that he is retiring, and so in advance of the end of his term at the end of this year. So, Mr. Belmont, if you will take it from here.
And we do have a date for that. He's actually going to retire effective May 31st of this year. Things moved a little quicker for him and his spouse in terms of where they're going to do and relocate and do things eventually here. So first thing I want to say is there'll be ample opportunities to honor the sheriff and his service to Lincoln County. We will have something here actually on May 31st here in the Board of Commissioners office to celebrate his service. So there will be a great opportunity to do that. So now, of course, when that announcement's made, we have to talk about what happens next. Unlike the discussion we had with the assessor's office and the procedures there, there are some qualifications for a person to be sheriff, including service qualifications, certifications through DPSST, Department of Public Safety and Standards Training. You got to have a carry right. Pretty good, the acronym. In this case, the process really has taken care of itself because the sheriff announced he was not running for office again, and the opportunity came up for people to file for that particular position. And that opportunity came up and has passed, and only one person has filed. That's Lieutenant Landers, who has filed for the position. So I don't think you need to go through any other process here other than making sure we make that succession occur in a timely fashion to make the appointment of Lieutenant Landers effective on June 1st when the sheriff retires on May 31st. There are some provisions under law. It's kind of interesting the way this works, and it's the ancient kinds of things of the sheriff does have to kind of pass the mantle over to the appointed sheriff. There's things, and including has to actually pass over the jail, people in the jail, inmates in the jail. So we'll need to work through some procedures to make sure that occurs in a timely fashion, but that's all set out by statute. But what I would be recommending that you do at this point is to have me prepare the order and we get this in place so there's an immediate succession to Lieutenant Landers. He will then stand for election. Actually, he still has to stand for election in November, but he will be the only person on the ballot in November. So.
Okay. Pleasure of the board.
Well, I think it's important to make the point that those of us that have voted realize that Lieutenant Landers' name is not on the ballot for the sheriff's position, but it will be in November, and it will be the only name on the ballot in November.
That's a statutory provision.
That's a statutory provision.
So if we make a decision prior to the November election, the reason his name wasn't on the May ballot is because of the statutory requirements.
That's correct.
Okay. So when can you have that order for us, Mr. Belmont?
I will prepare that for next week's meeting. We'll put that in place so that it immediately occurs on June 1st.
Okay. We've got consensus then.